When I walk in the door, the phone is already ringing. It is Janet on the other end. Janet, I was just going to call you.
Queen's College of Cork.
I beg your pardon?
I found a record from the school for a Patrick O'Reilly. He attended the Queen's College of Cork in Ireland. He enrolled in 1926.
I won't ask how you tracked that down, I say. There's more. He didn't graduate. But take a guess at what he studied.
Engineering?
Ding, ding, we have a winner.
The puzzle pieces are falling into place. Patrick O'Reilly is growing into more than words on a page. He is becoming real.
Janet continues. And you said he was in San Francisco in about 1931?
Yes.
The last record of him at the school is in 1930.
So he's our man, I say, as I catch myself bouncing from foot to foot.
Let me finish. There's more. You mentioned that your Mr. O'Reilly worked on the Golden Gate Bridge, right?
Yes, he did.
Well, in my digging, I learned that the Queen's College of Cork has a few famous graduates. Among them, a Mr. Michael Maurice O'Shaughnessy.
Does the name ring a bell?
I think so. Let me try to remember. The name sounds familiar. It has something to do with the bridge. But I can't put my finger on it.
Janet interrupts.
Let me help. He came from Ireland to San Francisco to become the city engineer. Turns out he was one of the early advocates of building a bridge across the gate. He was born in County Limerick, Ireland, which also happens to be the birthplace of Patrick O'Reilly.
What are you saying?
In this business, you make assumptions. Perhaps Patrick knew this guy or his family in Ireland. Perhaps this O'Shaughnessy is the one who convinced Patrick to come to America to work on the bridge. It's all plausible.
Is there more?
That's all for now. The most curious thing is that I haven't been able to trace him after he arrived in the United States. Usually that's where we have the most success.
I believe I can tell you why.
We found a letter from him here at the university. He dropped the O from his name. The family changed their name to just Riley.
Of course.
Will that help you track him?
You know me. I'm the one who can't put down a crossword puzzle.
Give me a couple more days, and I'll see what I can come up with.
Janet, every time we talk, your wedding gift gets more expensive.
I don't expect to hear back from Janet for at least 2 days. 3 hours later, she calls again.
Are you sitting down?
Yes. Looking for the right name made all the difference in the world. Let me tell you about your mystery man. Patrick O'Reilly was born in County Limerick, Ireland in 1899. I quickly do the math in my head and realize that when he started on the bridge, he was 32, older than I'd guessed.
Janet continues. He married Anna Sullivan in Ireland in 1925. She was from a village called Clada. I have records of Patrick at the university until 1930, but nothing in Ireland after that. That's the same time he pops up in San Francisco to work on the bridge. He's there until 1937. After that, it becomes tricky. I can track 7 different Patrick Rileys during the years that follow. Interestingly, 2 were married to women named Anna. I found church records for one of the 2 Patricks in Portsmouth, Virginia. If he's our man, then he had 3 children, 1 son and 2 daughters. The other possibility is a Patrick Riley in Washington, near Tacoma. If that's him, then the news isn't so good. He had 4 children, 1 boy and 3 girls. However, I found death dates for his wife and the children all on the same day. That means an accident, or perhaps an epidemic. If he's your man, then when he died in 1959... he died alone and with no posterity.
My mind races. I recall reading about the bridge in Tacoma. Construction started shortly after the Golden Gate Bridge was finished. Let's assume, Janet, that my Patrick is the man in Virginia. What did you find out about his children?
The trail with the 2 daughters went immediately cold. That's common. They no doubt married, changed their names, moved away. The son is easier since his name stays the same. He was christened Robert Riley. Personally, I wouldn't have named my kid Robert with the last name of Riley, but nobody asked me. It turns out Robert stayed in Virginia. He was Irish Catholic like his father. He married a woman named Louise Skinner. They also had a son. Here's the bad news. Robert Riley died of a heart attack 4 years ago. His wife died 2 years later. I have an old address, but I don't think that will do you much good. So where do I go from here? Katie, it's me, Janet. I told you they had a son. Do you want his phone number? You're serious? Remember, it helps only if I've traced the right Patrick Riley. We still have the guy who moved to Washington. It's a 50-50 shot as I see it. Janet, what's his name? The grandson, I mean. Is your pencil ready? Ready. His name is David. David Riley. Chapter 32. I wait patiently in the office courtyard, watching the elevators as they open and close, rehearsing what I'll say. There's a moment when I wonder if I have the courage. But then I remind myself that I need to find closure if I expect my life to move forward. An hour and 10 minutes later, he walks into the lobby. He's staring at his phone and doesn't notice that I'm there. It's my chance to speak up. Or walk away, silent forever. Eric? He jolts to a stop at the sound of my voice, turns toward me and stares. I watch his eyes drop, his head lower, his countenance crumble. He looks uneasy, even frightened. I hold my ground, not moving forward, but not stepping back. I wait. Katie? I saw you come into this building a few days ago. I live close by. I didn't want to keep avoiding the place. When he speaks, he looks past me, as if there were someone standing in the distance. Of all the ironies, the company transferred me back here. He tries to laugh, but it sounds forced, unnatural. I thought about looking you up, but I wasn't sure what the point would be. I expected to be angry. I expected to feel pain. Strangely, I feel only pity. He keeps glancing down nervously, and it strikes me as odd that he seems so vulnerable. Has he always been so insecure? His foot twitches nervously as he waits for stinging words that don't come. Instead, I watch, wait, and listen. After a minute, when it seems as if the silence will smother him, he speaks. Katie, it's just that... I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know what to say to you. I'm not here for an apology, Eric. I don't know if it's my words or my manner that surprise him the most. How's your life been? I ask. He stutters, stammers, takes a breath. It's been okay, I guess. Minutes ago, I'd been the terrified one. Now that the moment is here, I find my words flowing with confidence. Are you married? Dating? I ask. No. I mean, I go out once in a while. I guess you're married, though. That's great. I'm happy for you. His assumption catches me off guard. No, Eric, I'm not married. He looks bewildered, but he still refuses to look me in the eyes. I just presumed... Well, you look good, Katie. A lot thinner than I remembered. Eric, there's something I need to ask you. He takes another heavy breath, trying to anticipate what's coming. Katie, listen, I don't have an answer. I don't know why I did it. I've been over it again and again. It wasn't planned. It just happened. I can't help but smile. Eric, that's not my question. Oh, I'm sorry. What, then? I'm wondering about you, Eric. What do you mean? He shifts his weight as I pick my words. If life could be rewound to that moment when you were in L.A. and I was driving down from San Francisco, and the woman you were with appeared again from wherever she came from in the first place, would you do it again? My question seemed to surprise, even stun him, as if he's never looked inward, never probed his own character. Moments pass before he speaks. I made a stupid choice. I never meant to hurt you like I did. He pauses, fidgets some more. But I don't know that I could promise you, Katie, that I wouldn't make the same mistake all over again. How could I know something like that? It is a subtle realization, a pivot of understanding that, though slight, is also profound. In looking back, I find it interesting that such moments never come in the middle of the raging storm, but afterwards, in the gentle breeze of reflection and rebuilding. When Eric proposed to me, I viewed him as a partner on a pedestal, someone to lift me up. I leaned so heavily on his strength that, when he cheated, when his pedestal crashed over and knocked me breathless to the ground, I was afraid my leaning may have pushed it over. What I instantly understand in an ordinary lobby, on an ordinary day, in an extraordinary moment, is that I don't want to hand up. Nor do I want to push from behind. I want someone who will climb mountains with me, side by side. Despite my faults and weaknesses, despite my own insecurities, I deserve better. There is little more to say. Thank you, Eric, for being honest. Right now that means a lot to me. Good luck. I turn to walk away and he whispers his goodbye, visibly relieved that the ordeal is over. I am 3 steps away when I stop. Eric, wait. He turns, waits. I'm curious why you thought that I was married. After the question is asked, he glances down at my fingers, and I realize that he is looking at my ring. It was your faith ring. You're wearing it with the crown turned out. My blank stare is enough. For the first time, his laugh is genuine.
You of all people, a history major, and you don't know about the clot of faith rings? There's an irony there somewhere.
Can you tell me about them?
You don't need me for that. The story's out there. You were always an amazing researcher. I'm sure you'll find it.
But how do you know about...
Yeah. Me of all people. My grandmother used to wear one. She taught me.
And with that, he shrugs and walks away. Cladda. I'd heard the name from Janet. It was the town where Anna was born. It doesn't take me long at my computer before the legend of the Cladda faith ring smiles back from the screen. I learned that while several misty fables surround the creation of such a wondrous ring, the most common is of a man named Richard Joyce, who lived over 400 years ago in the fishing village of Cladda, Ireland, which overlooks Galway Bay. It is told that he sailed from the village to the plantations of the West Indies only days before he was to marry his true love. He was captured by Algerian pirates and sold as a slave to a Moorish goldsmith who trained him in his craft. In his captivity, Joyce fashioned the now-famous Cladda ring in memory of his only true love, the one he'd left waiting in Ireland. In 1689, Richard Joyce was finally released at the bidding of King William III. The Moor offered him his only daughter in marriage and half his wealth if he would remain in Algiers. But Joyce declined, and instead returned to the village to find his love unmarried and still waiting. The ring was presented, the couple were married, and they lived the rest of their lives happily together. As I read the simple fable and the story of the ring, I can't help but picture Patrick and Anna, each so distant, each so concerned about reuniting again. The legend must have held a special place for each. Patrick's words are now so plain and evident. With this crown,
I give my loyalty. With these hands, I promise to serve. With this heart, I give you mine.
I discovered that faith rings are still available today from many Irish jewelry shops. It is understood that if one wears the ring on the left hand with the crown turned outward, it is a sign that the person is blissfully committed. If the ring is worn on the right hand with the crown turned inward, then everyone knows that the wearer's heart is free.
Patrick and Anna are taking on depth and shape and life.
He didn't disappear after the bridge was finished. They were reunited. They remained committed.
Oh, there are still holes in the story. Traits about the man and his wife that I am left to imagine.
But if I do have the right Patrick Riley, I will have accomplished what my father couldn't. I will have found the rightful owner of Patrick's journal. All I have to do now is dial his grandson's number. I hold the phone against my ear, pick up my scribbled notes from Janet, and determinedly punch the keys. It rings once, and then twice. On the third ring, someone answers, and I hear a voice.
This is Dave Riley. I'm out right now. Please leave a number at the beep.
Chapter 33. Rising in the majestic Rocky Mountains of central Colorado, the South Platte River flows 420 miles northeast toward the central plains of Nebraska. It has done so for generations. The life-giving flow provides irrigation and hope to the many dotted towns sheltered along its valleys and basins. As Dave followed the river, the countless towns blurred: North Platte, Sutherland, Paxton, Roscoe, Brule, small towns, hometowns, 5,000 people here, 10,000 there, each a community harboring homes, farms, businesses, churches, and families. Sturdy names, solid names, Orchard, Hill Rose, and Big Springs. Every town the same, every town unique. All loved, despised, appreciated, and scorned by those who called them home. Just out of Big Springs, Nebraska, almost to the Colorado border, Dave pulled over to check his route. The battery on his phone was all but dead. Thankfully, he'd had the foresight to bring his printed maps. He traced the planned direction with his finger. The turnoff was just ahead, to I-80 West into Wyoming. He'd gas up at one of the towns along the way, find a home-cooked meal at the local diner, then stop for the night when he reached Cheyenne. It was only June 30th. He still had 5 days until the 4th. It was a 2-day ride, 2.5 days at most, to the coast. He would make it in time. Dave pushed the map back into his saddlebag and headed toward the freeway, accelerating up the on-ramp. Traffic was light, a far cry from New York or D.C., both of which felt so distant, in mileage and in memory. 2 18-wheel trucks ahead blocked both lanes of traffic as one passed the other. Dave slowed. He was on a Harley, so he could certainly roar around the left side and pass on the shoulder. But there was no point. He had time. He kept a steady pace behind the passing truck until it pulled over into the right lane to let him safely by. A half hour later, when the sign read Sterling, Colorado, 48 miles, Dave knew he'd taken the wrong road. He pulled off the freeway onto the frontage road. He must have missed the turnoff when passing the trucks. Now, 20 miles too late, he had two choices: backtrack or head toward Denver, looping up north on I-25 to Cheyenne. Even with the unexpected detour, it was early afternoon. He could still make Cheyenne by nightfall. It was the long way, but no worse than retracing country he'd already seen. With plenty of time to spare, going forward seemed the best option. A dot on the map, Liberty, Colorado, lay a few miles ahead. He would stay on the back roads and gas up his bike there. The town was visible from miles away, its whitewashed water tower poking high above the thick canopy of green trees that staked out its existence. Running parallel to the road grew a mile-wide thicket of cottonwood, cedar, and spruce trees, a forest that snaked along with the river for miles in each direction, evidence that water runs not only over the surface, but deep beneath as well. Farms trimmed the outskirts, blanketing the area for miles with corn, alfalfa, and hay, each irrigated field adding lushness to an otherwise arid rolling plain. Even from a distance, Dave could make out the outline of a large grain elevator that companioned the town's water tower. They stood adjacent, as if sentinels, protecting the residents from intruders. Dave guessed the structures would mark the town's center, its main street. The distant scene was picturesque, and Dave now congratulated himself for missing the turnoff. The only immediate problem was that he was starving. He hoped the town would have a diner with real food on the menu. Mashed potatoes, chicken, vegetables. Fast food burgers were wearing thin. The more his stomach rumbled, the harder he twisted the throttle, and the deeper the bike crooned. He would finish with apple pie. All hometown diners served apple pie. It was a requirement. He shifted the gears again, adding 5 miles per hour more to the speedometer. And then the bike sputtered. He twisted the throttle back and forth several times, but the bike continued to lose power. Dave checked for traffic behind and then pulled off to the side of the road. The fuel gauge showed a quarter of a tank. He removed the chrome gas cap and tipped the bike to see inside. The level looked about right. Plenty of fuel to make it to Liberty. Bad gas at the last stop? That didn't make sense, since he'd been driving all morning with no problems. From Red's maintenance lessons, Dave would have guessed the carburetor was at issue. But Red himself had gone over the bike with a fine-tooth comb and pronounced it in perfect condition. Dave set the kickstand, stepped off the bike, and glanced down the road in both directions. No cars in sight. The town was just ahead. Perhaps some premium gas would do the trick. He fiddled with several switches, adjusted the carburetor, and then pushed the start button again. Instead of rumbling alive, the engine sputtered and chugged. The bike lurched forward. It was running rough, but at least it was running. With a little luck, he'd make it into town, where he could get help. "With just a little luck," he repeated. The engine stalled completely half a mile later. Dave hated to leave the bike on the side of the road, and since the grade sloped gently toward town, he clicked the machine into neutral and started to push. It took nearly 30 minutes to reach the first building, a plumbing supply warehouse on the east side, with a red pickup truck parked in front. Across the street, to the west, a community ball diamond waited. Dave opted east. They'd certainly have a phone. He looked both ways. Still no cars. He was about to give his bike a heave to push it across the road, when something ahead near the baseball diamond caught his attention. It was built of polished river rock and stood about 3 feet high, adjacent to the three-tiered wooden bleachers behind home plate. It was a drinking fountain, the old-fashioned kind that had once dotted many city street corners before vandalism and city budgets put them on the endangered species list. But it wasn't the structure that caused Dave to pause. It was that the fountain was spewing torrents of crystal spring water. It was a call he couldn't refuse. He pushed the bike forward, close to the field, set the kickstand, and beelined toward the water. The mountain air was dry, the humidity non-existent compared with what he'd left behind. But the summer temperatures, coupled with the effort of pushing the bike, had left him exhausted and sweating profusely. His eyes locked on the stream that arched freely into the air and then down into a continuous splash, swirling in the cement bowl. As he approached, he mouthed a silent prayer. "Let it be cold. Please let it be cold." It was all he expected. He gulped, swallow after swallow, so quickly he thought he might get sick. When he could drink no more, he lowered his head and let the stream cascade over his hair and neck. Every inch of him that the water touched wept with gratitude. After several minutes of joy, he stepped aside and shook away the dripping water like a wet dog. With the bleachers adjacent, Dave found a seat to relax and let the water settle. For the first time, he noticed two young boys on the diamond behind the fence, one pitching balls to the other. As Dave rested, he couldn't help but watch their play. Once a coach, always a coach. They looked to be about 8 and 10 years of age, the younger of the two pitching to the older. Both had sandy blonde hair, cut short above the ears. The single bat they shared was oversized. When the boy swung, Dave cringed. His elbow was too low, and his grip on the bat was not high enough for his height. Out of habit, Dave stood, stepped to the chain-link fence, and grabbed it with his fingers. Three more pitches, three more misses. "Elbow up, Brad. Don't let him throw that garbage. Watch the ball. Keep your eye on the ball." Two more misses, then the youngster finally ticked one toward first base. With no one there to field the ball, he ran the bases. Rather than racing to home plate after retrieving the ball, the younger boy chased after the older one around second, then third base, then home. The run was scored. The younger boy never came close. "I'm ahead by 4, the older boy confirmed loudly. "So, it's my turn to hit now." They switched places and the game continued. His form was no better. He swung, he missed, he swung some more. Dave stayed at the fence. A familiar ache was rising in his chest. "The pitch will come in high, Brad. Watch the high pitch, and remember you have a man on third." Dave could feel his eyes begin to moisten. It was ridiculous. The young boys were having a great time. Why get emotional now? Dave reached up to shield the sun and wipe his eyes. "What's the matter? Don't you like baseball?" The young voice startled him. He hadn't noticed the girl standing near the bottom bleacher watching the boys as well. Her hair was not just blonde, it was almost white, and it curled just below her ears. She wore Levi's with holes in the knees and a navy blue shirt. It was hard to guess her age. 6, perhaps 7? "Nothing's the matter. And yes, I do like baseball." "Looked like you were crying." Dave wasn't sure how to answer. "Not at all. It's just that those boys are holding the bat wrong. I watched them and..." "Never mind, it doesn't matter." "Holding it wrong? How can you hold a bat wrong?" She was inquisitive, even amused. "Look closely and I'll show you." He moved over to the bleacher and sat beside her. Both watched as the boys continued. "See how his back elbow is pointing down? That means that when he swings, he will drift into the pitch. His bat will drag, and his timing will be off. The other boy is doing the same thing." She seemed truly interested, but bolted to her feet and ran to the edge of the fence. She hollered at them through chain-link openings. "Jared! Glenn! You're doing it wrong!" The boy's focus turned to the girl. It was the first time they'd noticed the stranger. "We are not," the younger of the two defended. "Are so," she shot back. "Are not. You don't know what you're talking about." They stepped toward her. "Are so," she repeated louder, this time pointing to Dave. "He said so." She waited for Dave, as if it were his turn to scream "are so" and defend her honor. Dave, more amused than embarrassed, wiped at his lips. "Technically," he began, "she's right. Your power is great, gentlemen, but you're not holding the bat like you should." Each boy scanned Dave independently, apparently sizing up the credibility of this sudden expert. Do you play? The older one asked. I used to coach a competition team on the East Coast. We took the division championship. Even went to state. Really? Sure. Do you want some pointers? They cast a quick glance at one another. The younger one shrugged. The older one nodded. Dave winked at the girl, laid his jacket on the bleachers, and then walked around the fence to where the boys stood. So who's Jared and who's Glenn? Dave asked as they reached home plate. I'm Jared. My brother is Glenn, the older one responded. And the girl? She's your sister? Yeah, that's Gracie. Gracie, Dave repeated it. It fit. At the plate, he spent some time helping each boy with his form. It felt good, very good, to be teaching baseball again. Look, you need to hold the bat higher. Right here. Good. Now close your grip. After a few minutes of instruction, Dave moved to the mound and pitched easy balls over the plate. Jared smacked one on his second swing. It rolled past second base into the outfield, the farthest he'd hit the ball all morning. Whoa! Jared exclaimed. The boys stared in sheer amazement, a sight that made Dave grin. Are you going to run or not? Dave yelled as he retrieved the ball. Jared ran the bases while Dave stepped back to the mound. Okay, Glenn, your turn. He played with the boys for nearly half an hour while Gracie watched patiently from the stands, clearly preferring spectator status. It was Glenn who finally asked, Is that your motorcycle? Dave had become so involved he'd forgotten about his bike. Yeah, it sure is. I'm having some problems with it, though. Is there a bike shop in town? Jared answered first. Ace Hardware sells bikes. Dave forced away his smile. Actually, I mean a motorcycle shop. You know, like a Harley dealer. After sharing a confused glance, the two boys shrugged. How about a phone, then? Dave asked. My battery is dead. Any of you have a phone on you that I can use? While the boys' heads shook, Gracie's lifted. We have a phone at home you can use, she said. She pointed to a small house beyond the left field fence, across an empty pasture. Dave accepted. Not wanting to leave his bike behind, he opted to push it around the long way. The children didn't mind a bit. The two boys marched in front, and Gracie tagged along behind. It was a one motorcycle parade. Chapter 34. When they had first moved into the area 4 years earlier, it had bothered Crystal to let the kids run free, to play by themselves. It was against her nature, her experience, to let them be so independent. Liberty was a small town, however, a safe town, and in time her worries abated. Today, when she noticed the children approaching with a stranger, her pulse quickened. The closer they got to the house, the angrier she became. After all, she had just had the stranger talk again with Gracie last week. Would that girl never learn? Crystal waited on the front porch as the posse approached. Gracie was the first to speak.
Mommy, look what we brought home!
Hello, Dave said, as he extended his hand. She shook it curtly, then pulled her hand away. She hated to be rude in front of the children. But bringing a biker home? It was not acceptable. Is everything okay? Can I help you with something? She asked briskly. Gracie chimed in again.
He wants to use the phone. His motorcycle's busted.
Then, without hesitation, she added,
And he showed Jared and Glenn how to bat because they were doing it wrong, and he's really good.
The boys shrugged sheepishly, both old enough to realize that once this guy was gone, they were toast. Dave stepped in. I don't mean to bother you. My bike broke down a couple of miles from town. I pushed it to the ball diamond. The kids volunteered your phone. If it's too much trouble, I'll look somewhere else. She had watched the news, seen the horror stories that occur when you let your guard down. She felt her pocket. It was empty. After another moment of hesitation, she cautiously relented.
It's fine. Come on in. My cell is in the bedroom, but we have a landline in the kitchen.
Before opening the door, she spoke to the children.
Kids, you stay outside and play. Do you hear me?
By the look on her face and the tone of her voice, they knew she meant business. She pulled the door open and pointed toward the kitchen. She let him step in first and then followed a few steps behind, close enough to watch, but at enough of a distance to run for the door if necessary.
The phone is in there on the counter. My husband will be home soon, and he's pretty handy. Perhaps he can help fix your bike.
Dave walked down the short hall in the direction she had pointed. A bathroom door hung open nearby. A full-length mirror covered the inside. He jolted to a confused stop when he noticed his reflection. Wet shirt, hair sticking out in all directions, his face covered in a dark stubble.
I look pretty scary, don't I? He said.
She wasn't sure how to respond.
No. Yes. Well...
And I probably smell just as bad? Her mouth was open, but no words would come out. Silence lingered in the air until Bolt began to laugh.
Yes, you do, she finally admitted. You smell horrible.
She extended her hand as if for the first time.
I'm Crystal Davis.
Dave shook it again. Her icy stare thawed.
I'm Dave Riley, and I promise I don't always smell like this.
It's the heat. Don't worry about it. Then she added, and the phone is on the counter. He hesitated.
I don't mean to be a bother, but do you have a computer? I need to find the number for the nearest motorcycle shop.
I can grab my cell, but I can tell you already the only shop in town that can work on motorcycles is Darren's RV. It's after 6 now. He'll be closed. His eyes darted to the clock on the wall. He'd missed it by half an hour.
If you don't mind, I'd like to try.
She grabbed her phone from the bedroom, tapped on the screen to find the number, and then called. Bolt listened to it ring, then switched to voicemail.
How about some premium gas? Is there a station close? He asked.
Believe it or not, we do have gas stations. Let me see if I can find an empty can, and I'll run you down to the Texaco.
Just point me in the direction. I can walk.
He looked rough and smelled worse. But even so, he was certainly the most polite biker she'd ever met.
Look, it's not a problem. I can take you.
She opened the door and waited for him to follow. A metal can was located, and the kids were loaded into the car. She waited for him to climb into the passenger seat and then pulled out of the driveway.
So, what does your husband do?
She glanced into the rearview mirror and checked the children.
He works for the school district. He'll be home a little later. Some days he works late.
She understood he was trying to be polite, trying to make conversation. In truth, his questions made her nervous.
And how about yourself? Dave asked.
She slowed at the intersection and pretended to look for traffic. There was none. Her answer was brief, bordering on curt.
I teach.
He didn't prod or push further. And with the exception of polite, one-word responses to questions from the children, he said nothing more. Gracie pressed her hands intently against the inside glass of the family room window. Her eyes shifted between Dave and his bike. Crystal found her behavior curious. Even more peculiar was the fact that Jared and Glenn had both volunteered to help with dinner, though their motives were soon betrayed.
Mom, can we get a new bat? Jared asked.
You already have a bat.
Yeah, but it's too big.
Too big? How can a bat be too big?
It is, Mom, Glenn piped in. Dave said so, and he coached a state team.
Is that so? Both nodded, waiting for her response.
Let's talk about it tomorrow. Now go wash up.
She turned toward the family room and called,
Gracie, go wash up for dinner.
The little girl either purposefully ignored her or was so intently focused on the subject outside that she didn't hear. "Hello, are you in there?" Crystal chided, raising her voice until Gracie turned in her direction. "Go wash up now. Dinner is almost ready." Crystal moved to the window next to where her daughter stood and glanced out at Dave. He sat motionless on the ground beside his bike. As she watched, Gracie posed the question she'd been pondering.
"Mom, can we keep him?"
Crystal bit her lip to keep from laughing. "He's not a pet. He's a person. So no, dear, we can't keep him." Gracie's sigh was obvious.
"Just till tomorrow."
Crystal bent down and swatted her daughter lightly on the behind, then pushed her toward the bathroom.
"Go wash your hands. I'll walk out and see how he's doing."
Dave was deep in thought, staring up at the bike, or past it, when she approached.
"I've got some dinner ready."
The words startled him, and he jumped.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to scare you."
"That's okay. No luck with the bike?" He shook his head. "It's not the fuel, but I'm embarrassed to admit I don't know that much about the engine. It just doesn't make sense. My friend Red looked it over before I left and said it was flawless. I guess my best hope is to get it to a bike shop in the morning."
"Tomorrow?"
she questioned. "Is that a problem?"
"Not for me, but for them it will be. It's Sunday tomorrow. The only shop in town will be closed."
"Today's Saturday?" He looked at the numbers on his watch and then counted the days backwards.
"You didn't realize?" Crystal said.
"I guess I lost a day somewhere. And there's just the one shop?"
"The next closest would be in Sterling, but that's a good 40 minutes away, and I'm guessing they'll be closed tomorrow as well.
Look, I have dinner ready. You're welcome to join us and then figure it out afterwards." Dave had been starving hours ago. Right now, he would eat gravel.
"Thanks, it smells great."
Dave walked beside her to the house. On their way, she began to apologize.
"We don't always eat this late, so please don't think I'm a delinquent mother. It's just with summer and it being light so late, well, anything besides cold cereal is considered a treat."
"Delinquent? Hardly. I used to coach kids. I'm a good judge of their character. Trust me when I tell you that you're raising some great children." She accepted the praise with a smile, as if compliments were too few and far between to do otherwise.
"You know," she said, "it's nice to hear that once in a while. Do you have children of your own?"
His step quickened, his mouth pinched closed. He was slow to answer.
"I have 3, he finally said.
She nodded, but didn't pry further. As they neared the house, Crystal motioned to the window where Gracie stood watching.
"Well, there's a 6-year-old girl inside who is mesmerized."
When they neared the door, Dave reached out to open it for Crystal. At the sight of his own grease-covered hands, he jerked back.
"You think I smelled bad before? You'd better add oil and gasoline to the list."
She grabbed the knob to pull the door open herself and then stepped past him.
"That's okay," she answered dryly.
"Gasoline is an improvement." The food was delicious, the conversation light, even pleasant. The boys finished quickly and asked to be excused to watch TV. Crystal obliged. Gracie picked at her food, prolonging the event, as if not wanting to miss anything at the table. As Crystal and Dave continued their conversation, Gracie listened.
"So what kind of work do you do?" Crystal asked.
"I work for a marketing research firm in Manhattan."
"How about you? You said you were a teacher?"
"Third graders."
"Bet that keeps you busy."
"And you said your husband works at the school district? Is he a teacher as well?"
"No, he's not."
Crystal eyed Gracie, noticed her glass half empty, and poured her more water. Dave waited for an explanation, but when none came, he continued.
"Listen, I'm sorry. It's none of my business."
Gracie was trying her best to separate the food left on her plate into distinct piles. She didn't appear to be paying attention to the two adults.
He often works late, Crystal replied. It's just the way it is. Her answer was rushed, like it had been in the car when David first broached the subject. Gracie set down her knife, then turned toward Dave, as if she'd been a part of the conversation the entire time. Mommy's not married anymore. She met Crystal's glare with innocence. Are you, Mommy? Crystal coughed, then flushed red. Not married? Dave asked, as if a coup had been exposed right there at the table. Gracie shook her head, causing her thin, white blonde hair to flip from side to side. Nope. When Dave turned toward Crystal with a smile, she relented. I didn't mean to lie. It's what you're supposed to do when a stranger comes into your house. Especially a long-haired, smelly biker who hasn't shaved in a week, Dave added. She shrugged back. Anyone ready for a dessert? It caught Crystal off guard when Dave carried the dinner dishes to the sink. She appreciated the help, and he seemed like a nice guy. She just knew so little about him. And most troubling, how stable was a biker? Crystal, it was a terrific dinner. You've been very nice to me. But I'd better find a place to spend the night. Is there a motel nearby? Common sense battled loneliness. They're building a new one on the far side of town, but it won't be done for several months. Fact is, most people don't stop here. They go on ahead to Sterling. Other than that, I think all we have is a sundowner. That works. She hesitated. Well, is there a problem? It's called the sundowner for a reason. The sun set a long time ago on that place. It's kind of dumpy. It'll be fine. In fact, if you want to point me in the general direction, I'll walk. Oh, quit it with the walking thing. Your politeness is making me nervous. It's a 5-minute drive. I'll take you. She didn't mind dropping him off, but the thought of loading up the kids one more time was more than she could handle. She turned to Dave. You're about to realize I'm not such a great mother after all. Then she called out to her kids. Gracie, go get in bed right now. Jared, you're in charge. I'll be back in 10 minutes. Any other time, Jared would have complained. With Dave watching, he stood attentive. Crystal continued. You know the rules. Don't answer the phone. Don't answer the door. I'll take my cell phone. It'll be just 10 minutes, so you and Glenn watch TV until I get back. Then it's bedtime. Gracie began her protest. No fair! How come they get to watch TV and I don't? It didn't take much tonight to get Mom to cave. 10 minutes, Gracie, that's all. Then you get into bed, no questions asked. And I don't want to come back to hear that you were a pain. Deal? Deal. Dave grinned, as if perhaps the routine looked familiar. While Crystal grabbed her keys, Dave retrieved a few personal items from his bike's saddlebags. When she pulled up the car, he climbed inside. So you won't report me to the authorities? She asked. Actually, I am the state child inspector. I'm placing you under arrest. They smiled together. The motel was just a few minutes away, so while driving, Crystal offered up a little background. She explained that the complex had been originally built in the late 1940s. To cater to fishermen who were expected to flock into the area once the levees upstream regulated the river's flow. The fishermen apparently had never materialized. Since then, the single row of 8 dilapidated cabins had been strung together with a slipshod roof, so they would be taxed as 1 building and not 8. Separate bathrooms had been added to the back of each unit in a remodel 10 years later. No one in town could ever explain to Crystal why indoor plumbing hadn't been part of the original plan, except to say that fishermen prefer the great outdoors. Tonight, as they approached, light from the almost full moon was casting an eerie glow across the complex, though the buildings themselves were completely dark. While the place may have been described as quaintly rustic in its day, it hadn't approached rural charm in years. 5 of the 8 cabin doors were wide open, with nary a soul in sight. Rugs and carpet had been pulled out of the units and were draped over the front railings.
The light on the parking area's single pole was out as well. It was a parking lot normally covered with a hefty layer of gravel, but when Dave rolled down his window for a closer inspection, he could see moonlight reflecting off what looked to be a 3-inch-deep lake. Just like you said, it is a bit, well, run down, isn't it? Dave commented dryly. Crystal started to laugh. Calling the place a dive was too kind. It was a disaster area. I swear it wasn't like this a few days ago. It looks like they had a water leak or something. Or the dam broke, Dave added. Now what? Unless you're a good swimmer, you can't stay here, she said, stating the obvious. The next closest place is almost an hour away, and I can't leave the kids that long. How about a campground? You mean like a KOA? She asked. Sure, any kind. I'm easy. I can't think of one. We're not big campers. She paused for a moment, her head bobbing back and forth slightly, weighing the pros and cons of an idea that had been rattling around in her brain. Listen, we have a space in our front yard. You can roll your sleeping bag out there. You do have a sleeping bag, don't you? I do, but I hate to impose. Under the circumstances, can you think of a better choice? He paused, obviously sorting his options. I won't be a bother, I promise. Now you better get out of this lot before we're both stuck in this car for the night. By the time Crystal had chased Gracie to bed, Dave had his sleeping bag rolled out next to his bike. He appeared to be looking at the stars. Jared stepped to the window beside his mother and watched Dave for a moment with her. How come he gets to sleep outside and we don't? He whined. She was losing her patience. I told you to get in bed, right now. I'm not going to tell you again. Glenn was still in the kitchen getting a drink of water. When he returned, she marched beside both boys to the bathroom and waited while they brushed their teeth. After they had been duly tucked in, she kissed them on the cheek and then offered her final threat, as if it would help. If you get out of bed, there will be extra chores in the morning. Hear me? When they both agreed, she left to check on Gracie. Thank goodness one of the three was asleep. Then, in stocking feet so the boys wouldn't hear, she slipped back to the window to watch Dave. He was such a pleasant guy, though his appearance was still perplexing. He didn't seem as rough as he looked, as threatening as the image led one to believe. He simply wasn't your average biker. Or was he? She'd seen them riding in groups down the freeway from time to time. But as she thought about it, she'd never really stopped one. Were they all this nice? Even from the window, she could tell he was awake. He kept shifting his position on the hard ground. The voices, the arguments, started once again in her head. 5 minutes later, she stepped outside and marched toward him. She didn't bother with the typical good evening. Listen, if my mother knew, she'd kill me. If word gets around town, I'm done for. For the record, it's against my better judgment, but why don't you come inside and just sleep on the couch? Can I bring my guns and knives? Sure, why not? She answered. It had been such a long time since a guy had made her laugh. Dave picked up his sleeping bag and a few things from the bike. Once inside, he rolled out his bag on the couch. Can I make you some coffee? She asked. That would be great. He followed her to the kitchen, and while they waited for the water to boil, they sat at the table and talked. It was small talk at first, though it didn't take long to get to the questions each wanted to ask. No husband. Does that mean you're divorced? She nodded. He took off when I was pregnant with Gracie. 8 months pregnant, to be exact. He left a note. A note. Can you believe that? Like I was a one-night stand. I'm sorry. It's okay. Though to this day, it amazes me that a person could be so cruel. Another woman? There's always another woman. I haven't seen him, though. In 5.5 years, since our last court date. I heard he moved to some place in Florida. What kind of father would walk away from such terrific kids? Dave didn't need to answer. Do the kids remember him? The boys? Not really. Probably better that way. So, how about you, Dave Riley? I noticed you're wearing a ring, and you said you have 3 children. I take it you're married? He hated to go into detail, so he kept his answer short. My wife was killed in a car accident a few months ago. She winced. I am so sorry. That's okay. I'm still a little, well, confused about it, actually. She was surprised when he continued. I had 3 children. I lost them also. I'm sorry if earlier I implied otherwise. You're talking to the woman who told you her husband was coming home. More smiles. That explains it, though, she added. Explains what? Why you're great with the kids. You've had some practice. The coffee maker on the counter beeped as it finished draining. Crystal retrieved the pot and poured 2 cups. After taking a few sips, Dave opted for a change of subject. Is this your hometown? No. We've been here 4 years now. We lived in Kansas City. I tried to keep the house there as long as I could, but it was a big house and, well, things don't always work out like you expect, do they? No, they don't. What brought you here, then? 2 things. A job, for one. The district had an opening, and I needed the work. And the second? To get away from the memories. To have a place where I could start fresh. Create my own life. Does that seem too weird? Not at all. After their cups were empty, Crystal poured more. The boys said you coached a baseball team, she said. Tell me about that. She found his company pleasing. He seemed to feel the same about her. They laughed at the same jokes, reflected when no words needed to be spoken. Each listened. It was 1:30 in the morning before she noticed her watch. Oh, my. Have you seen the time? She asked. I'm sorry to keep you up. No, it was a pleasure, and I didn't mean to talk your ear off. With the 3 children at home and then more during the day when school is on, well, I don't get much of a chance to carry on normal adult conversations. Before she stood, she reached out and touched his hand, resting on the table. It was a casual touch, a token of friendship, and yet a soft touch. As her fingers rested on his, his arm tensed, as if he wanted to pull it away, but couldn't. She spoke sincerely while holding her grasp. Really, thank you for listening. When she let go, he moved his hand under the table. I have the same problem, and I don't even teach school. Well, good night, Dave Riley. Thanks again. Good night. Dave could feel his quickened pulse as Crystal walked from the kitchen, down the hall, and into her own bedroom. He listened to the sound of her door closing before he clicked off the light and dropped back into the chair. The sounds of her getting ready for bed permeated the small house. He looked down, then shook his fingers as if they were asleep, as if the blood had stopped flowing and he needed to start it again. The air was suddenly stifling, and he wished that he'd stayed outside beneath the stars. Still, he didn't move. He waited until her room was quiet, until the rhythm of his own breath had slowed, before moving to the bathroom to get himself ready for bed. He undressed in total darkness. After he'd climbed inside his sleeping bag, he listened again for any further sound, any hint that anyone else was also awake. Nothing. His eyes burned. The sun would be coming up in just a few more hours, and he needed to sleep. Instead, His thoughts swirled in a tangled mix of confusion. He didn't have time for this delay. He had to get his bike fixed. Most important, he had to get to the bridge.